Argument is State of Minnesota versus Irwin James Sam. Good morning, Council. While you are getting settled, I'll just remind you that you each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Council, for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you state the name of your name and the party you represent, because we are recording these proceedings today, and you can adjust the podium as you need to. You must be Mr. Gokey.
I am.
All right. Welcome to Minnesota and the Minnesota Court of Appeals.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
And when you are both ready, you may proceed, Mr. Gokey.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Charlie Gokey for appellant Irwin James Sam. This case concerns a routine traffic stop that took place as appellant and his friend stepped out of appellant's car into the parking lot of a tourist destination during daylight and during business hours. Now, almost as soon as the stop began, it exceeded all constitutional bounds, becoming an intrusive criminal investigation based on no more than conjecture about, and I quote the state's brief, some form of criminal drug activity. Now, within moments of initiating the stop, the state trooper in this case first questioned appellant regarding alleged drug use and then frisked him. That was the state's burden to justify both expansions of this routine traffic stop. And for the reasons set forth in appellant's briefs, appellant admits that the state can justify neither. That said, in the interest of time, and except to the extent the court has other questions, I plan to focus my argument today on the second expansion of the stop, the frisk, as that presents especially clear grounds for a reversal in this case.
I just want to make sure, one point in your brief, you quote Billups, and it's 0 + 0 + 0 = 0. And so I just want to make sure that I understand the zeros that you are focusing on. First, there's the presence in the casino parking lot on the first Thursday of the month. Nervous behavior, bloodshot eyes, pale skin, butane fuel, in the proximity to Mr. Nicoboyne and his criminal record. Were there any other zeros that you focused on or think we should look at?
I think that it's, again, the state's burden to be focusing you on ones rather than
right.
zeros. So I don't know that there's anything necessarily. I mean, there are certainly other things that the district court cited in its opinion as justifying the state troopers.
Well, it seemed to be the things you focused on in your briefing.
Yes, because those are the things focused on by the district court in its opinion. The reason why I'm focusing today on the frisk instead of the drug-related questioning is because I think the district court erred clearly in its analysis of the frisk here, which I think the state tacitly concedes by abandoning the district court's rationale on appeal. Now, the state attempts to cobble together.
Sorry, could you say that again? I didn't quite hear you.
The district court erred in its analysis of the frisk here, which I believe the state tacitly concedes by abandoning the district court's rationale on appeal. Now, the state attempts to cobble together
Can you elaborate? How does the state abandon the rationale?
So if you look at pages 8 and 9 of the addendum here, the district court lays out its rationale for upholding the frisk of appellant in this case. The district court leads by saying that key to its analysis is a connection between drugs and guns. And the district court then proceeds to list a number of circumstances that relate to drug use or possession. And then concludes by saying these observations that I've just listed justified the frisk in this case. Now, it's black-letter law in this jurisdiction that mere suspicion of drug use, possession, or even low-level sale is insufficient to justify a frisk, and the state doesn't contend otherwise in its brief.
Well, what about the fact, and you can't see it, but you can hear it. I mean, the repeated reaching for the pocket after the officer said, get your hands out of your pocket. And this all happened very quickly, I acknowledge that. But isn't that one of the circumstances that would justify the frisk?
Well, I'd say first that there are cases decided by this court observing that putting one's hands in one's pockets is merely a commonplace nervous behavior. And I think, importantly, the state trooper in this case did not instruct appellant to take his hands out of his pockets until the moment he initiated the frisk. Essentially, he said, get your hands off your pockets, I'm going to frisk you now.
But he also made a statement that you keep reaching for your pocket, so it seems like it had been done repeatedly. Isn't that something that could reasonably cause an officer to be concerned about what's in that pocket?
Well, if the officer had a reasonable concern about what was in the pocket, it seems strange that since this conduct began at the outside of the stop, as the trooper testified, he at no point prior to announcing the frisk requested that appellant not put his hands in his pockets. And I'll note that the district court in this case made no factual finding to the effect that appellant appeared to be reaching for a weapon. There was no testimony by the trooper that appellant appeared to be hiding something in his waistband or that there was any sort of bulge on his person that appeared to be a weapon, which I think sets this case well apart from all of the cases relied upon by the state. I mean, for example, one of the primary authorities cited by the state relied upon in its briefs is State v. Flowers. Now, in State v. Flowers, the court upheld the frisk of a motorist who refused to pull over for an extended period of time during a stop, forcing the police to chase him, but during that time was observed for 45 seconds, frantically attempting to hide something that the police believed to be a gun. This is a repeated theme in the cases cited by the state here. For example, the state also cites United States v. Robinson, an Eighth Circuit case, as a case upholding a frisk on similar facts to this one. Now, I mean, there are many differences here. For example, Robinson involved a drug sting, not a routine traffic stop. It involved an individual who is known to be a drug dealer, not an unknown individual, as in this case. And the suspect in Robinson stepped out of a crack house, a large-scale drug operation, not into the parking lot of a tourist destination. But most importantly, in Robinson, as the officers approached the suspect was observed attempting to hide something in his waistband that could have been a gun. Now, in all of these cases, there's some sort of concrete reason, something more than mere conjecture that justified invading the personal space and the body of the suspect in question. And simply put, there's no similar fact in this case. And ultimately, that is why the state's argument here fails. The state cannot show that appellant or that the state trooper in this case reasonably believed appellant to be armed and dangerous. I mean, these cases that I'm just talking about now are the measuring stick that the state has asked this court to apply to this case. And the gulf between their facts and the facts here dramatically illustrates how far the state is from satisfying its burden on the armed and dangerous standard.
Does it matter that in this case there were multiple people in the car and that some of the other people were putting their hands in their pockets or otherwise, from the officer's perspective, attempting to conceal something? Does that matter?
Well, again, here, I think that it's important that the officer never asked these individuals to take their hands out of his pockets, which I think reflects, at the time, his
I think he did. He asked the woman, I forgot her name, he asked Mr. Nicobone to, why do you have your hand where it is? Why can I not see your hand, or why is your hand out of view, or something like that?
You're correct. He did ask Mr. Nicobone that question, but that was after the frisk had begun. In fact, Mr. Nicobone had been in his view the entire time leading up to that, the state trooper testified. So what we're talking about now are facts that, frankly, do not really come into play here because they transpired after an illegal expansion of a search.
And I can't remember, I watched the video, but it seems that Mr. Nicobone and Ms. Nicobone are really aware that they can't put their hands in their pockets. Because when you watch the video, and I can't remember, it's throughout it, like when Nicobone's going to put his lighter in his pocket, he's like, officer, here it is. Is it okay if I put it there? And so the Nicobones at least seemed to be aware that they were not supposed to put their hands in their pockets.
And yet it was also the state trooper's testimony in this case that when they were off camera, they did in fact put their hands in their pockets repeatedly.
But that was after he asked him not to.
I don't know that that's necessarily the case, but if that is, I can address it in a letter brief to the court after the fact.
Well, and I can go back and watch it again and just see what the timing is.
No, and I'm glad that the court has taken the time to watch the video, which I do believe is very instructive. It shows, in fact, that Mr. Sam's passengers in this case were nothing if not cooperative and, in fact, even friendly during the stop, which, returning to your question, I believe is crucial to the cases that are under discussion here. It's very common that a police officer will pull over a car that has more passengers than there are officers, but it's rare that a frisk is justified. And you know, if you take a look at the case cited by the state to justify the frisk based on the number and position of appellant's passengers, it's a case involving, again, not a traffic stop, but a drug surveillance in a high crime area where an officer observed an individual attempt to hide something the officer believed to be a gun in his ankle. And during the stop, the suspects became uncooperative, forcing the officers to attempt to regain control of the situation, frisking everybody involved. Now, that is not what happened here. There was no indication that anybody had hidden a gun, nor was anybody uncooperative.
But as I remember, I think it was the testimony, because, again, we can't see it on the video. I mean, Mr. Sam wouldn't step away from the vehicle either. I mean, he was sort of blocking the trooper's access and sort of in a weird way, was he not?
I believe you may have that backwards, actually.
Okay.
So the state trooper in this case, as soon as Mr. Sam began stepping out of his car, immediately stepped up to Mr. Sam and got within about a foot of him and trapped him in what was about a 3-foot pocket of his door frame. What happened was Mr. Sam actually attempted to extricate himself from that awkward position. He said, excuse me.
Right, I mean, the trooper didn't want him moving, and he was trying to move away, as I recall. And that was one of the things that gave the trooper some concern. And then he saw the butane and then noted I mean, it all happened so quickly.
Yes, well, again, if you do watch the video, you'll see that the trooper does not specifically tell Mr. Sam that he wants him to remain in the 3-foot pocket of the door frame. And I think that it belies the assertion by the state that Mr. Sam was doing something untoward, that Mr. Sam politely said, excuse me, before attempting to close the door of the car. And again,
lock it, right?
And to lock it, which, if he was going into the casino, I think is only a natural thing to do on your way out of the parking lot. So the state trooper, I'll note, also did not, at the time that this happened, voice any apprehension regarding Mr. Sam's actions, but merely said, we're standing here. And after that, there's no testimony that appellant made any further efforts to extricate himself from this 3-foot pocket.
Well, part of the problem is that you have to put the trooper's testimony together with the video.
Mm-hmm.
Because the video is pointing away from the events that you're talking about. And while that's going on, we're watching the Nicomoines eat a snow cone and try to smoke and do other things. And so it's silent as to what's going on physically with regard to the trooper and Sam when he's standing in the door, and yet the trooper testified to that.
Certainly, but what I'm saying is that the trooper's testimony was also that appellant said, excuse me, politely before closing the door.
Well, it was a very cordial encounter.
Certainly, which I think goes to show how radical and, frankly, unusually rapid the expansion of this traffic stop was. I'll note that the state, I just want to take a moment to address the state's inevitable discovery doctrine argument here. The state ultimately falls back on the inevitable discovery doctrine, arguing that the state trooper in this case would have inevitably searched appellant's passenger, MN. But if you look at the testimony in this case from the state trooper, there's no testimony that the state trooper would have searched MN, or sorry, Mr. Nicoboyne, absent finding a bullet on appellant's person. He testified only that he found the bullet on appellant's person and then moved on to search appellant's passengers. Now, this doctrine does not apply when there is an element of speculation, and it is mere speculation that the state trooper, during a routine traffic stop, and as Mr. Nicoboyne was, as you noted, simply eating a snow cone peacefully, would have gone over and searched this passenger from a car in a routine traffic stop. I'll also note that the doctrine only applies if there is some other lawful means of recovering evidence, but if the circumstances here did not justify searching appellant, they would not have justified searching Mr. Nicoboyne. Now, the state says that there are differences in the circumstances surrounding each. That's correct. The state trooper never testified that he believed Mr. Nicoboyne to be armed and dangerous. That testimony does not appear in the transcript. The state also notes that Mr. Nicoboyne at one point had a warrant out for somehow involving weapons, but there's nothing in the record that would suggest this warrant justified the search here. I mean, it's not even clear from the record whether or not any weapons were discovered, but beyond that, there are other questions left unanswered that I think would need to be answered. The state would need to supply that evidence before that warrant would really be entitled to wait here. Now, this is a case in which a state trooper did precisely what the Minnesota Supreme Court has said he may not. May I finish my
You may
thought?
Sum
Thank
up
you.
Your...
This is a case in which a state trooper did precisely what the Minnesota Supreme Court has said a law enforcement officer may not do, and that is, and I'm quoting here, make searches upon apprehending motorists for simple traffic violations or upon the slightest hint of illegality. That's a quote from State v. Fernando. To affirm the search here would be to dramatically expand an exception to the constitutional protections of the Minnesota and United States constitutions, and appellant urges the court not to do so.
Judge Bjorkman, could I ask one more question, please? You've argued, I think, you've challenged two expansions, I think, in your brief. First,
Correct.
Questioning, second, frisking.
Yes.
Did Mr. Sam's lawyer in the district court make an argument about that the questioning was an expansion?
The brief in the district court is, I will admit, unclear in terms of when the first expansion of the stop occurred. I'll note that the district court itself expressed some confusion on that. I think that it's fair to say that on appeal, a party is free to elaborate on arguments that were made below but were not specifically were not made with like a high degree of specificity. I think that the brief in the district court leaves open the possibility of arguing that this expansion of the stop was unconstitutional.
All right, thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel, and may it please the Court, my name is Ed Stockmeyer. I'm an Assistant Attorney General appearing this morning on behalf of Respondent, the State of Minnesota. When properly viewed in their totality and with deference to Trooper Otterson's informed inferences, the circumstances known to Trooper Otterson at the time that the stop expanded provided him with a reasonable articulable suspicion that Mr. Sam may have been involved in some form of drug activity, and also that Mr. Sam may have been armed at that time. I will also focus my argument on the frisk, but before I do that, I think it is important to discuss the reasonable articulable suspicion standard, because I do think that Mr. Sam's argument really rests on heightening that standard to something higher than the Constitution requires. So the reasonable articulable suspicion standard has two elements. First, the state has to point to some objective facts known to the trooper at the time of the challenge conduct. We point out the facts that we're relying on. Second, those facts must permit a reasonable inference of criminal activity, and in the context of a frisk, specifically the criminal activity in question is whether the suspect is armed. And the important thing to note about that second step of a reasonable articulable suspicion analysis is that we're talking about reasonable inferences. And those reasonable inferences do not have to be exclusive, so we do not have to exclude other alternative inferences for each of the facts. They do not have to rise to the level of certainty. They don't even have to be particularly strong inferences. They have to be reasonably drawn from the circumstances known to the trooper.
And in this case, I can follow your argument with respect to a suspicion of drug activity. But where do we have any evidence from which inferences can be drawn that Mr. Sam had a weapon?
Certainly, Your Honor. So the facts at the first step of the reasonable suspicion analysis here are that, yes, the Mr. Sam may have been involved in some drug activity along with the people he was with. He also took some steps to try to conceal that activity. The concerning part of his attempt to conceal that activity involved...
You're talking about the blocking the entrance or not staying in front of the car door when he...
Well, he, in terms of trying to conceal that activity, he tried to shut the door. He tried to lock the door. The trooper testified that he appeared to become more alarmed once he understood that the trooper was trying to look into the car. But I think the most concerning part is that Mr. Sam tried to extricate himself from the doorway, and to do so, he had to physically go through Trooper Otterson. And it's been described as a cordial interaction. It didn't become overly aggressive, but I don't think that that's a cordial interaction. The trooper testified that that gave him cause to be concerned about his safety. So you have this sort of unpredictable behavior that indicates at least some willingness to engage in a physical confrontation with the trooper. You also have the fact that the trooper testified and the district court found that that Mr. Sam was moving his hands towards his pockets throughout the interaction. It's a relatively brief interaction, but that's a finding from the district court. And in addition, before the frisk was initiated, and we have to remember we take the facts known at the moment the challenge conduct is initiated, the trooper specifically instructed Mr. Sam to stop putting his hands in his pockets. Mr. Sam then again went ahead and moved his hands to his pockets instead of putting his hands on the car as instructed, and the trooper then had to more aggressively instruct him to stop putting his hands towards the pocket. And
at
that point...
At the time he said, I mean, he was already starting to do the frisk, wasn't he, when he actually made the statement, get your hand out of your pocket?
So it's not 100% clear, but let me walk Your Honor through why I don't think this frisk had been initiated at that point. And this really depends on the timing of everything, so I'm going to really focus on the timestamp of the video. So at the timestamp on the video is 20:12:03. The trooper tells Mr. Sam to keep his hands out of his pockets. The district court had found before then he was putting his hands in his pockets. 1 second later, he asks Mr. Sam if he has any weapons, and then 3 seconds later at 20:12:07, he tells him he's going to frisk him because he keeps putting his hands in his pockets. He specifically said, because you keep putting your hands in his pockets. At 20:12:10, he instructs Mr. Sam to turn around and put his hands on the car. And the testimony, I'm going to revert now to the transcript, he testified that Mr. Sam did not comply with that command and that instead of putting his hands on the car, Mr. Sam, quote, reaches down to his right side to go to that pocket. That's from page 35 of the transcript. Then at 12:12:11, 1 second after the trooper told him to turn around, the trooper can be heard saying, don't stop reaching for that right side. So I think if you look at the timing here, 1 second has passed since he instructs Mr. Sam to put his hands on the car. I don't think we can say that the frisk had already been initiated when the trooper has to give a second repeated command to stop reaching for his pockets.
Mr. Gokey seemed to say that you were conceding the first part and moving on to inevitable discovery.
I understood my friend's argument to be that we were abandoning the analysis that the district court made on the frisk. I don't agree with that. I think the district court's order, and this happens sometimes in frisk cases because reasonable suspicion of criminal activity separate from the weapons is actually a part of a frisk analysis. The district court sort of lumped the two together. So the district court was addressing why there is reasonable suspicion for drugs and also why there is reasonable suspicion for a weapon. And when we got to the armed part, the district court's analysis didn't go through step by step why each of the facts suggested that the trooper was armed, but the district court did refer to the totality of circumstances of what the trooper had testified to. The district court specifically said that it found credible that the trooper had made all those observations in this quick period. So I think that's all part of what the district court's analysis is. So even though our articulation of the analysis may be more detailed and specific than the district court's, I don't believe it's accurate that we're abandoning the district court's analysis. I think the district court's analysis was just fine in referring to the totality of the circumstances. And I would point out that all the facts we're referring to were specifically found by the district court in the factual finding part of its analysis. This court is a de novo review. The question for whether the frisk was lawful is whether the totality of circumstances known to the officer justified the frisk. And so even if the district court's legal analysis gave short shrift to the question, all those facts are found in the factual findings of the order, and this court can rely on those facts for a de novo review. So just to reiterate, We have the reasonable suspicion of drug activity. We have Mr. Sam engaging in this unpredictable and slightly physically confrontational behavior with the trooper. We have the movement of his hands towards his pockets. He has to be instructed not to do so. He moves his hands towards his pockets again. And so I think when we take all of those facts, there is a particularized suspicion that Mr. Sam may have been hiding something in his pocket and that the trooper needed to frisk him in order to ensure that he could safely investigate his suspicion about drug activity. And just a quote from the Supreme Court in Terry, the trooper, quote, had to make a quick decision as to how to protect himself and others from possible danger, and he took limited steps to do so. And so I think based on the totality of circumstances known to the trooper, there was reasonable suspicion that Mr. Sam may be armed, and the frisk was therefore necessary. And unless this court has any further questions, I'll forego the remainder of my time and simply ask this court to affirm the convictions.
So I just have a point of curiosity. Yeah. I had never seen the phrase target glancing. Is that something that law enforcement is talking about now?
I'm not sure I've come across that phrase specifically. The way I understood the testimony was seemed pretty sensible to me that when somebody is nervous that they may have some contraband, in order to reassure themselves when they're interacting with an officer and concerned that that contraband may be discovered, there is a natural, maybe instinctive glancing towards where it's hidden. I think the trooper seemed to appear to apply the same sort of rationale to the reaching towards the pockets. He was concerned that Mr. Sam had something in his pockets, in part because Mr. Sam seemed to be instinctively just reaching towards his pockets. I think it's sort of a nervous tick. That makes sense to me. I haven't necessarily seen it in other cases, but it does make sense.
Could I ask a question about the inevitable discovery argument that you've made? What in this case, what evidence would be necessary to support that argument? What evidence is in the record, and what additional evidence might be gained by another evidentiary hearing, which I think is your alternative request?
Correct. I think the additional evidence would be, as my friend pointed out, maybe more particulars on what the trooper had, how the trooper planned to go forward with his drug investigation. But what we're relying on, the fact is, there was a legitimate drug investigation going on. This wasn't a case where if he didn't find anything on Mr. Sam's person, he would have let these people go. There was an ongoing concern about drugs. The investigation would have been ongoing. Mr. Nickaboyne, his criminal history absolutely involved weapons. The trooper testified to that. The district court found it credible. And Mr. Nickaboyne was also engaging in the behavior in hiding his hands. So I think the frisk of him was lawful. I admit that those are the same sort of factors we're relying on for Mr. Sam, and so there may be an extent to which those two go hand in hand, but I think there are particular circumstances with Mr. Nickaboyne that are different from Mr. Sam.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Gokey, you have the last word.
With respect to the state's request for a possible remand on the issue of inevitable discovery, I'll again note, as we did in our brief, that the case the state relies on for that is a case in which there was not a hearing on that issue, as opposed to this case in which there was a hearing on that issue, in which the state attempted at length to solicit all of the evidence it needed to support this exception to the suppression doctrine. Now, the state solicited that evidence, rested its case, and submitted it to the district court. And if there's not enough evidence in the record to support this exception, that means only that the state failed to carry its burden, not that the state gets to try this again. Otherwise, you know, gross unfairness would result to all criminal defendants, if that's how this works.
You don't think the state should get a mulligan?
I certainly do not, and I hope the court feels the same way. Also, with respect to target glancing, I believe that the definition that was just given, again, was, I think, not the same definition given by the state trooper during his testimony. The state trooper testified, I believe, that target glancing is looking in all directions when you're thinking of fleeing, not looking specifically at areas where contraband may be hidden. But I think both of those are sort of side issues. The most important thing here is, you know, we were just talking about the three things that the state believes supported the frisk of Mr. Sam. There was the, I think we called it the slightly physical act of attempting to extricate himself from the doorframe. There was the vague suspicion of some sort of drug-related activity. And then there was the sort of nervous behavior of putting his hands in his pockets. I would invite the court to compare those justifications for the frisk to the cases cited by the state in support of the frisk. And again, I think that the court will be impressed by the distance between those meager facts and the facts in the cases relied upon by the state.
Does the troopers experience that there's a link between drugs and guns in many cases? Is that part of a circumstance at all, or something that the district court shouldn't have listed in the numerous circumstances that justified the frisk?
The possibility of drug activity is one circumstance among the totality that a court can consider in determining whether there was a reasonable suspicion that an individual is armed and dangerous. But it is, again, as I said, black-letter law here, that it is not sufficient, that there is not a strong enough link to support a frisk on that basis. And you know, this court has held that in multiple cases. I'll also note that the court in Flowers observed, this is a case decided by the Minnesota Supreme Court, relied upon by the state, that the strength of the suspicion of illegal activity is something that the court can consider in determining whether or not a frisk was reasonable, or rather, whether it was reasonable to believe an individual to be armed and dangerous. And I think here, the inference of illegal activity is slight at best. Now, the state has said in its argument today that appellant is attempting to heighten the reasonable suspicion of criminal activity standard. I don't think that's the case. I think what the case is that if one simply examines the circumstances of this case, one sees that despite a sinister gloss that can be offered on them, all of them are essentially innocent. And, you know, cases decided by federal courts, for example, the Tenth Circuit and Wood, have explained that, you know, innocent circumstances can't support a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity unless there's some concrete reason for that. And I don't think that we've heard anything from the state that would support concretely the inference that there was some sort of drug-related activity here. I would also like to address the state's point in saying that Mr. Sam was attempting to conceal something by closing his car door. I'm not entirely sure how Mr. Sam could have been attempting to conceal something when the state trooper had already looked into the car. Moreover, the car door had a window on it. If anything, the closing of the door was an attempt to extricate himself from an awkward position in which he was trapped, which I think is consistent with the district court's findings. I'm just about out of time. Thank you very much for your consideration in this case.
Thank you. Thank you both for your helpful arguments. The case was well presented. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.
Thank you.